cultivated land for years. As in other parts of sub-Saharan Africa, the use of the plow was new in agriculture, but when given the opportunity, African farmers seem to have been quite ready to adopt the technology. They were also prepared to invest in wagons and irrigation works. As the agricultural economy developed, the rigid tribal institutions started to give way. There was a great deal of evidence that changes in property rights to land took place. In 1879, the magistrate in Umzimkulu of Griqualand East, in the Transkei, noted the growing desire of the part of natives to become proprietors of land. They have purchased 38,000 acres. 3 years later, he recorded that around 8,000 African farmers in the district had bought and started to work on 90,000 acres of land. Africa was certainly not on the verge of an industrial revolution, but real change was underway. Private property in land had weakened the chiefs and enabled new men to buy land and make their wealth, something that was unthinkable just decades earlier. This also illustrates how quickly the weakening of extractive institutions and absolutist control systems can lead to newfound economic dynamism. One of the success stories was Stephen Sanjika in the Siskai, a self-made farmer from a poor background. In an address in 1911, Sanjika noted how when he first expressed to his father his desire to buy land, his father had responded, "Buy land? How can you want to buy land? Don't you know that all land is God's, and he gave it to the chiefs only?" Sanjika's father's reaction was understandable, but Sanjika was not deterred. He got a job in King Williamstown and noted, "I cunningly opened a private bank account into which I diverted a portion of my savings. This went only until I had saved 80 pounds. I bought a span of oxen with yokes, gear, plow, and the rest of agricultural paraphernalia. I now purchased a small farm. I cannot too strongly recommend farming as a profession to my fellow man. They should, however, adopt modern methods of profit-making." An extraordinary piece of evidence supporting the economic dynamism and prosperity of African farmers in this period is revealed in a letter sent in 1869 by a Methodist missionary, W.J. Davis. Writing to England, he recorded with pleasure that he had collected 46 pounds in cash for the Lancashire Cotton Relief Fund. In this period, the prosperous African farmers were donating money for relief of the poor English textile workers. This new economic dynamism, not surprisingly, did not please the traditional chiefs, who, in a pattern that is by now familiar to us, saw this as eroding their wealth and power. In 1879, Matthew Bligh, the chief magistrate of the Transkei, observed that there was opposition to surveying the land so that it could be divided into private property. He recorded that some of the chiefs objected, but most of the people were pleased. The chiefs see that the granting of individual titles will destroy their influence among the headmen. Chiefs also resisted improvements made on the lands, such as the digging of irrigation ditches or the building of fences. They recognized that these improvements were just a prelude to individual property rights to the land, the beginning of the end for them. European observers even noted that chiefs and other traditional authorities, such as witch doctors, attempted to prohibit all European ways, which included new crops, tools such as plows, and items of trade. But the integration of the Siskai and the Transkei into the British colonial state weakened the power of the traditional chiefs and authorities, and their resistance would not be enough to stop the new economic dynamism in South Africa. In Fingoland, in 1884, a European observer noted that the people had transferred their allegiance to us. Their chiefs have been changed to a sort of titled landowner, without political power. No longer afraid of the jealousy of the chief or of the deadly weapon, the witch doctor, which strikes down the wealthy cattle owner, the able counselor, the introduction of novel customs, the skillful agriculturalist, reducing them all to the uniform level of mediocrity, no longer apprehensive of this, the Fingo clansman is a progressive man. Still remaining a peasant farmer, he owns wagons and plows. He opens water furrows for irrigation. He is the owner of a flock of sheep. Even a modicum of inclusive institutions and the erosion of the powers of the chiefs and their restrictions were sufficient to start a vigorous African economic boom, Alas, it would be short-lived. Between 1890 and 1913, it would come to an abrupt end and go into reverse. During this period, two forces worked to destroy the rural prosperity and dynamism that Africans had created in the previous 50 years. The first was antagonism by European farmers, who were competing with Africans. Successful African farmers drove down the price of crops that Europeans also produced. The response of Europeans was to drive the Africans out of business. The second force was even more sinister. The Europeans wanted a cheap labor force to employ in the burgeoning mining economy, and they could ensure this cheap supply only by impoverishing the Africans. This they went about methodically over the next several decades. The 1897 testimony of George Albu, the chairman of the Association of Mines, given to a commission of inquiry, pithily describes the logic of impoverishing Africans so as to obtain cheap labor. He explained how he proposed to cheapen labor by simply telling the boys that their wages are reduced. His testimony goes as follows. Commission. Suppose the Kaffirs, black Africans, retire back to their kraal, cattle pen. Would you be in favor of asking the government to enforce labor? Albu. Certainly. I would make it compulsory. Why should a nigger be allowed to do nothing? I think a Kaffir should be compelled to work in order to earn his living. Commission. If a man can live without work, how can you force him to work? Albu. Tax him, then. Commission. Then you would not allow the Kaffir to hold land in the country, but he must work for the white man to enrich him? Albu. He must do his part of the work of helping his neighbors. Both of the goals of removing competition with white farmers and developing a large low-wage labor force were simultaneously accomplished by the Natives Land Act of 1913. The Act, anticipating Lewis's notion of dual economy, divided South Africa into two parts, a modern prosperous part and a traditional poor part, except that the prosperity and poverty were actually being created by the Act itself. It stated that 87% of the land was to be given to the Europeans, who represented about 20% of the population. The remaining 13% was to go to the Africans. The Land Act had many predecessors, of course, because gradually Europeans had been confining Africans onto smaller and smaller reserves. But it was the Act of 1913 that definitively institutionalized the situation and set the stage for the formation of the South African apartheid regime, with the white minority having both the political and economic rights, and the black majority being excluded from both. The Act specified that several land reserves, including the Transkei and the Ciskei, were to become the African homelands. Later, these would become known as the Bantustans, another part of the rhetoric of the apartheid regime in South Africa, since it claimed that the African peoples of Southern Africa were not natives of the area, but were descended from the Bantu people, who had migrated out of eastern Nigeria about 1,000 years before. They thus had no more, and of course in practice less, entitlement to the land than the European settlers. Map 16 shows the derisory amount of land allocated to Africans by the 1913 Land Act and its successor in 1936. It also records information from 1970 on the extent of a similar land allocation that took place during the construction of another dual economy in Zimbabwe, which we discuss in Chapter 13. The 1913 legislation also included provisions intended to stop black sharecroppers and squatters from farming on white-owned land in any capacity other than as labor tenants. As the Secretary for Native Affairs explained, the effect of the Act was to put a stop for the future to all transactions involving anything in the nature of partnership between Europeans and natives in respect of land or the fruits of land. All new contracts with natives must be contracts of service. Provided there is a bona fide contract of this nature, there is nothing to prevent an employer from paying a native in kind, or by the privilege of cultivating a defined piece of ground. But the native cannot pay the master anything for his right to occupy the land. To the development economists who visited South Africa in the 1950s and 60s, when the academic discipline was taking shape and the ideas of Arthur Lewis were spreading, The contrast between these homelands and the prosperous modern white European economy seemed to be exactly what the dual economy theory was about. The European part of the economy was urban and educated and used modern technology. The homelands were poor, rural, and backward. Labor there was very unproductive, people uneducated. It seemed to be the essence of timeless backward Africa. Except that the dual economy was not natural or inevitable. It had been created by European colonialism. Yes, the homelands were poor and technologically backward, and the people were uneducated. But all this was an outcome of government policy, which had forcibly stamped out African economic growth and created the reservoir of cheap, uneducated African labor to be employed in European-controlled mines and lands. After 1913, vast numbers of Africans were evicted from their lands, which were taken over by whites and crowded into the homelands, which were too small for them to earn an independent living from. As intended, therefore, they would be forced to look for a living in the white economy, supplying their labor cheaply. As their economic incentives collapsed, the advances that had taken place in the preceding 50 years were all reversed. People gave up their plows and reverted to farming with hoes, that is, if they farmed at all. More often, they were just available as cheap labor, which the homelands had been structured to ensure. It was not only the economic incentives that were destroyed. The political changes that had started to take place also went into reverse. The power of chiefs and traditional rulers, which had previously been in decline, was strengthened, because part of the project of creating a cheap labor force was to remove private property in land. So the chief's control over land was reaffirmed. These measures reached their apogee in 1951, when the government passed the Bantu Authorities Act. As early as 1940, G. Findlay put his finger right on the issue. Tribal tenure is a guarantee that the land will never properly be worked and will never really belong to the natives. Cheap labor must have a cheap breeding place, and so it is furnished to the Africans at their own expense. The dispossession of the African farmers led to their mass impoverishment. It created not only the institutional foundations of a backward economy, but the poor people to stock it. The available evidence demonstrates the reversal in living standards in the homelands after the Natives Land Act of 1913. The Transkei and the Siskei went into a prolonged economic decline. The employment records from the gold mining companies collected by the historian Francis Wilson show that this decline was widespread in the South African economy as a whole. Following the Natives Land Act and other legislation, miners' wages fell by 30% between 1911 and 1921. In 1961, despite relatively steady growth in the South African economy, these wages were still 12% lower than they had been in 1911. No wonder that over this period, South Africa became the most unequal country in the world. But even in these circumstances, couldn't black Africans have made their way in the European modern economy, started a business, or have become educated and begun a career? The colonial government made sure these things could not happen. No African was allowed to own property or start a business in the European part of the economy, the 87% of the land. The apartheid regime also realized that educated Africans competed with whites, rather than supplying cheap labor to the mines and to white-owned agriculture. As early as 1904, a system of job reservation for Europeans was introduced in the mining economy. No African was allowed to be an amalgamator, an assayer, a banksman, a blacksmith, a boilermaker, a brass finisher, a brass molder, a bricklayer. And the list went on and on, all the way to woodworking machinist. At a stroke, Africans were banned from occupying any skilled labor in the mining sector. This was the first incarnation of the famous color bar, one of the several racist inventions of South Africa's regime. The color bar was extended to the entire economy in 1926 and lasted until 1982. It is not surprising that black Africans were uneducated. The South African state not only removed the possibility of Africans benefiting economically from an education, but also refused to invest in black schools and discouraged black education. This policy reached its peak in the 1950s when, under the leadership of Hendrik Verwoerd, one of the architects of the apartheid regime that would last until 1994, the government passed the Bantu Education Act. The philosophy behind this act was bluntly spelled out by Verwoerd himself in a speech in 1954. "The Bantu must be guided to serve his own community in all respects. There is no place for him in the European community above the level of certain forms of labor. For that reason, it is to no avail to him to receive a training which has as its aim absorption in the European community, while he cannot and will not be absorbed there." Naturally, this type of dual economy articulated in Verwoerd's speech is rather different from Lewis's dual economy theory. In South Africa, the dual economy was not an inevitable outcome of the process of development. It was created by the state. In South Africa, there was to be no seamless movement of poor people from the backward to the modern sector as the economy developed. On the contrary, the success of the modern sector relied on the existence of the backward sector, which enabled white employers to make huge profits by paying very low wages to black unskilled workers. In South Africa, there would not be a process of the unskilled workers from the traditional sector gradually becoming educated and skilled, as Lewis's approach envisaged. In fact, the black workers were purposefully kept unskilled and were barred from high-skill occupations so that skilled white workers would not face competition and could enjoy high wages. In South Africa, black Africans were indeed trapped in the traditional economy in the homelands. But this was not the problem of development that growth would make good. The homelands were what enabled the development of the white economy. It should also be no surprise that the type of economic development that white South Africa was achieving was ultimately limited, being based on extractive institutions the whites had built to exploit the blacks. South African whites had property rights, they invested in education, and they were able to extract gold and diamonds and sell them profitably in the world market. But over 80% of the South African population was marginalized and excluded from the great majority of desirable economic activities. Blacks could not use their talents. They could not become skilled workers, businessmen, entrepreneurs, engineers, or scientists. Economic institutions were extractive. Whites became rich by extracting from blacks. Indeed, white South Africans shared the living standards of people of Western European countries, while black South Africans were scarcely richer than those in the rest of sub-Saharan Africa. This economic growth without creative destruction, from which only the whites benefited, continued as long as revenues from gold and diamonds increased. By the 1970s, however, the economy had stopped growing. And it will again be no surprise that this set of extractive economic institutions was built on foundations laid by a set of highly extractive political institutions. Before its overthrow in 1994, the South African political system vested all power in whites, who were the only ones allowed to vote and run for office. Whites dominated the police force, the military, and all political institutions. These institutions were structured under the military domination of white settlers. At the time of the foundation of the Union of South Africa in 1910, the Afrikaner polities of the Orange Free State and the Transvaal had explicit racial franchises, barring blacks completely from political participation. Natal and the Cape Colony allowed blacks to vote if they had sufficient property, which typically they did not. The status quo of Natal and the Cape Colony was kept in 1910, but by the 1930s, blacks had been explicitly disenfranchised everywhere in South Africa. The dual economy of South Africa did come to an end in 1994, but not because of the reasons that Sir Arthur Lewis theorized about. It was not the natural course of economic development that ended the color bar and the homelands. Black South Africans protested and rose up against the regime that did not recognize their basic rights and did not share the gains of economic growth with them. After the Soweto Uprising of 1976, the protests became more organized and stronger, ultimately bringing down the apartheid state. It was the empowerment of blacks who managed to organize and rise up that ultimately ended South Africa's dual economy in the same way that South African whites' political force had created it in the first place. Development reversed. World inequality today exists because during the 19th and 20th centuries, some nations were able to take advantage of the Industrial Revolution and the technologies and methods of organization that it brought, while others were unable to do so. Technological change is only one of the engines of prosperity, but it is perhaps the most critical one. The countries that did not take advantage of new technologies did not benefit from the other engines of prosperity either. As we have shown in this and the previous chapter, this failure was due to their extractive institutions, either a consequence of the persistence of their absolutist regimes, or because they lacked centralized states. But this chapter has also shown that in several instances, the extractive institutions that underpinned the poverty of these nations were imposed, or at the very least further strengthened, by the very same process that fueled European growth: European commercial and colonial expansion. In fact, the profitability of European colonial empires was often built on the destruction of independent polities and indigenous economies around the world, or on the creation of extractive institutions essentially from the ground up, as in the Caribbean islands, where, following the almost total collapse of the native populations, Europeans imported African slaves and set up plantation systems. We will never know what the trajectories of independent city-states, such as those in the Banda Islands, in Aceh, or in Burma, Myanmar, would have been without the European intervention. They may have had their own indigenous glorious revolution, or slowly moved toward more inclusive political and economic institutions based on growing trade in spices and other valuable commodities. But this possibility was removed by the expansion of the Dutch East India Company. The company stamped out any hope of indigenous development in the Banda Islands by carrying out its genocide. Its threat also made the city-states in many other parts of Southeast Asia pull back from commerce. The story of one of the oldest civilizations in Asia, India, is similar, though the reversing of development was done not by the Dutch, but by the British. India was the largest producer and exporter of textiles in the world in the 18th century. Indian calicos and muslins flooded the European markets and were traded throughout Asia and even Eastern Africa. The main agent that carried them to the British Isles was the English East India Company. Founded in 1600, 2 years before its Dutch version, the English East India Company spent the 17th century trying to establish a monopoly on the valuable exports from India. It had to compete with the Portuguese, who had bases in Goa, Chittagong, and Bombay, and the French with bases at Pondicherry, Chandernagore, Yanam, and Karaikal. Worse still for the East India Company was the Glorious Revolution, as we saw in Chapter 7. The monopoly of the East India Company had been granted by the Stuart kings and was immediately challenged after 1688 and even abolished for over a decade. The loss of power was significant, as we saw earlier, because British textile producers were able to induce Parliament to ban the import of calicos, the East India Company's most profitable item of trade. In the 18th century, under the leadership of Robert Clive, the East India Company switched strategies and began to develop a continental empire. At the time, India was split into many competing polities, though many were still nominally under the control of the Mughal emperor in Delhi. The East India Company first expanded in Bengal in the east, vanquishing the local powers at the battles of Plassey in 1757 and Buxar in 1764. The East India Company looted local wealth and took over, and perhaps even intensified, the extractive taxation institutions of the Mughal rulers of India. This expansion coincided with the massive contraction of the Indian textile industry, since, after all, there was no longer a market for these goods in Britain. The contraction went along with deurbanization and increased poverty. It initiated a long period of reverse development in India. Soon, instead of producing textiles, Indians were buying them from Britain and growing opium for the East India Company to sell in China. The Atlantic slave trade repeated the same pattern in Africa, even if starting from more backward conditions than in Southeast Asia and India. Many African states were turned into war machines, intent on capturing and selling slaves to Europeans. As conflict between different polities and states grew into continuous warfare, state institutions, which in many cases had not yet achieved much political centralization in any case, crumbled in large parts of Africa, paving the way for persistent extractive institutions and the failed states of today that we will study later. In a few parts of Africa that escaped the slave trade, such as South Africa, Europeans imposed a different set of institutions, this time designed to create a reservoir of cheap labor for their mines and farms. The South African state created a dual economy, preventing 80% of the population from taking part in skilled occupations, commercial farming, and entrepreneurship. All this not only explains why industrialization passed by large parts of the world, but also encapsulates how economic development may sometimes feed on and even create the underdevelopment in some other part of the domestic or the world economy. Chapter 10. The Diffusion of Prosperity. Honor Among Thieves. 18th century England, or more appropriately Great Britain, after the 1707 union of England, Wales, and Scotland, had a simple solution for dealing with criminals, out of sight, out of mind, or at least out of trouble. They transported many to penal colonies in the empire. Before the War of Independence, the convicted criminals, convicts, were primarily sent to the American colonies. After 1783, the independent United States of America was no longer so welcoming to British convicts, and the authorities in Britain had to find another home for them. They first thought about West Africa, but the climate, with endemic diseases such as malaria and yellow fever, against which Europeans had no immunity, was so deadly that the authorities decided it was unacceptable to send even convicts to the white man's graveyard. Their next option was Australia. Its eastern seaboard had been explored by the great seafarer Captain James Cook. On April 29, 1770, Cook landed in a wonderful inlet, which he called Botany Bay, in honor of the rich species found there by the naturalists traveling with him. This seemed like an ideal location to British government officials. The climate was temperate, and the place was as far out of sight and mind as could be imagined. A fleet of 11 ships packed with convicts was on its way to Botany Bay in January 1788, under the command of Captain Arthur Phillip. On January 26th, now celebrated as Australia Day, they set up camp in Sydney Cove, the heart of the modern city of Sydney. They called the colony New South Wales. On board one of the ships, the Alexander, captained by Duncan Sinclair, were a married couple of convicts, Henry and Susanna Cable. Susanna had been found guilty of stealing and was initially sentenced to death. This sentence was later commuted to 14 years and transportation to the American colonies. That plan fell through with the independence of the United States. In the meantime, in Norwich Castle Jail, Susanna met and fell in love with Henry, a fellow convict. In 1787, she was picked to be transported to the new convict colony in Australia with the first fleet heading there. But Henry was not. By this time, Susanna and Henry had a young son, also called Henry. This decision meant the family was to be separated. Susanna was moved to a prison boat moored on the Thames. But the word got out about this wrenching event and reached the ears of a philanthropist, Lady Cadogan. Lady Cadogan organized a successful campaign to reunite the Cables. Now they were both to be transported with young Henry to Australia. Lady Cadogan also raised £20 to purchase goods for them, which they would receive in Australia. They sailed on the Alexander, but when they arrived in Botany Bay, the parcel of goods had vanished, or at least that is what Captain Sinclair claimed. What could the Cables do? Not much, according to English or British law. Even though in 1787 Britain had inclusive political and economic institutions, this inclusiveness did not extend to convicts who had practically no rights. They could not own property. They could certainly not sue anyone in court. In fact, they could not even give evidence in court. Sinclair knew this and probably stole the parcel. Though he would never admit it, he did boast that he could not be sued by the Cables. He was right, according to British law. And in Britain, the whole affair would have ended there, but not in Australia. A writ was issued to David Collins, the judge advocate there, as follows. Whereas Henry Cable and his wife, new settlers of this place, had before they left England a certain parcel shipped on board the Alexander transport Duncan Sinclair Master, consisting of clothes and several other articles suitable for their present situation, which were collected and bought at the expense of many charitable disposed persons for the use of the said Henry Cable, his wife and child. Several applications has been made for the express purpose of obtaining the said parcel from the master of the Alexander now lying at this port, and that without effect, save and except a small part of the said parcel containing a few books, the residue and remainder, which is of a more considerable value, still remains on board the said ship Alexander, the master of which seems to be very neglectful in not causing the same to be delivered to its respective owners as aforesaid. Henry and Susanna, since they were both illiterate, could not sign the writ and just put their crosses at the bottom. The words "new settlers of this place" were later crossed out, but were highly significant. Someone anticipated that if Henry Cable and his wife were described as convicts, the case would have no hope of proceeding. Someone had come up instead with the idea of calling them new settlers. This was probably a bit too much for Judge Collins to take, and most likely he was the one who had these words struck out. But the writ worked. Collins did not throw out the case, and convened the court with a jury entirely made up of soldiers. Sinclair was called before the court. Though Collins was less than enthusiastic about the case, and the jury was composed of the people sent to Australia to guard convicts such as the Cables won. Sinclair contested the whole affair on the grounds that the Cables were criminals, but the verdict stood, and he had to pay £15. To reach this verdict, Judge Collins didn't apply British law. He ignored it. This was the first civil case adjudicated in Australia. The first criminal case would have appeared equally bizarre to those in Britain. A convict was found guilty of stealing another convict's bread, which was worth 2 pence. At the time, such a case would not have come to court, since convicts were not allowed to own anything. Australia was not Britain, and its law would not be just British. And Australia would soon diverge from Britain in criminal and civil law, as well as in a host of economic and political institutions. The penal colony of New South Wales initially consisted of the convicts and their guards, mostly soldiers. There were few free settlers in Australia until the 1820s, and the transportation of convicts, though it stopped in New South Wales in 1840, continued until 1868 in Western Australia. Convicts had to perform compulsory work, essentially just another name for forced labor, and the guards intended to make money out of it. Initially, the convicts had no pay. They were given only food in return for the labor they performed. The guards kept what they produced. But this system, like the ones with which the Virginia Company experimented in Jamestown, did not work very well, because convicts did not have the incentives to work hard or do good work. They were lashed or banished to Norfolk Island, just 13 square miles of territory, situated more than 1,000 miles east of Australia into the Pacific Ocean. But since neither banishing nor lashing worked, the alternative was to give them incentives. This was not a natural idea to the soldiers and guards. Convicts were convicts, and they were not supposed to sell their labor or own property. But in Australia, there was nobody else to do the work. There were, of course, Aboriginals, possibly as many as 1 million at the time of the founding of New South Wales. But they were spread out over a vast continent, and their density in New South Wales was insufficient for the creation of an economy based on their exploitation. There was no Latin American option in Australia. The guards thus embarked on a path that would ultimately lead to institutions that were even more inclusive than those back in Britain. Convicts were given a set of tasks to do, and if they had extra time, they could work for themselves and sell what they produced. The guards also benefited from the convicts' new economic freedoms. Production increased, and the guards set up monopolies to sell goods to the convicts. The most lucrative of these was for rum. New South Wales at this time, just like other British colonies, was run by a governor appointed by the British government. In 1806, Britain appointed William Bligh, the man who 17 years previously, in 1789, had been captain of the HMS Bounty during the famous mutiny on the Bounty. Bligh was a strict disciplinarian, a trait that was probably largely responsible for the mutiny. His ways had not changed, and he immediately challenged the rum monopolists. This would lead to another mutiny, this time between Bligh and the monopolists, led by a former soldier, John MacArthur. The events, which came to be known as the Rum Rebellion, again led to Bligh's being overpowered by rebels, this time on land rather than aboard the Bounty. MacArthur had Bligh locked up. The British authorities subsequently sent more soldiers to deal with the rebellion. MacArthur was arrested and shipped back to Britain. But he was soon released, and he returned to Australia to play a major role in both the politics and economics of the colony. The roots of the Rum Rebellion were economic. The strategy of giving the convicts incentives was making a lot of money for men such as MacArthur, who arrived in Australia as a soldier in the second group of ships that landed in 1790. In 1796, he resigned from the army to concentrate on business. By that time, he already had his first sheep, and realized that there was a lot of money to be made in sheep farming and wool export. Inland from Sydney were the Blue Mountains, which were finally crossed in 1813 and revealed vast expanses of open grassland on the other side. It was sheep heaven. MacArthur was soon the richest man in Australia, and he and his fellow sheep magnates became known as the squatters, since the land on which they grazed their sheep was not theirs. It was owned by the British government. But at first this was a small detail. The squatters were the elite of Australia, or more appropriately, the squatocracy. Even with a squatocracy, New South Wales did not look anything like the absolutist regimes of Eastern Europe or of the South American colonies. There were no serfs, as in Austria-Hungary and Russia, and no large indigenous populations to exploit, as in Mexico and Peru. Instead, New South Wales was like Jamestown, Virginia, in many ways. The elite ultimately found it in their interest to create economic institutions that were significantly more inclusive than those in Austria-Hungary, Russia, Mexico, and Peru. Convicts were the only labor force, and the only way to incentivize them was to pay them wages for the work they were doing. Convicts were soon allowed to become entrepreneurs and hire other convicts. More notably, they were even given land after completing their sentences, and they had all their rights restored. Some of them started to get rich, even the illiterate Henry Cable. By 1798, he owned a hotel called the Ramping Horse, and he also had a shop. He bought a ship and went into the trade of sealskins. By 1809, he owned at least 9 farms of about 470 acres and also a number of shops and houses in Sydney. The next conflict in New South Wales would be between the elite and the rest of the society, made up of convicts, ex-convicts, and their families. The elite, led by former guards and soldiers such as MacArthur, included some of the free settlers who had been attracted to the colony because of the boom in the wool economy. Most of the property was still in the hands of the elite, and the ex-convicts and their descendants wanted an end to transportation, the opportunity of trial by a jury of their peers, and access to free land. The elite wanted none of these. Their main concern was to establish legal title to the lands they squatted on. The situation was again similar to the events that had transpired in North America more than a century earlier. As we saw in Chapter 1, the victories of the indentured servants against the Virginia Company were followed by the struggles in Maryland and the Carolinas. In New South Wales, the roles of Lord Baltimore and Sir Anthony Ashley Cooper were played by MacArthur and the squatters. The British government was again on the side of the elite, though they also feared that one day MacArthur and the squatters might be tempted to declare independence. The British government dispatched John Bigg to the colony in 1819 to head a commission of inquiry into the developments there. Bigg was shocked by the rights that the convicts enjoyed, and surprised by the fundamentally inclusive nature of the economic institutions of this penal colony. He recommended a radical overhaul. Convicts could not own land. Nobody should be allowed to pay convicts' wages anymore. Pardons were to be restricted, Ex-convicts were not to be given land, and punishment was to be made much more draconian. Big saw the squatters as the natural aristocracy of Australia, and envisioned an autocratic society dominated by them. This wasn't to be. While Big was trying to turn back the clock, ex-convicts and their sons and daughters were demanding greater rights. Most important, they realized, again, just as in the United States, that to consolidate their economic and political rights fully, they needed political institutions that would include them in the process of decision-making. They demanded elections in which they could participate as equals and representative institutions and assemblies in which they could hold office. The ex-convicts and their sons and daughters were led by the colorful writer, explorer, and journalist William Wentworth. Wentworth was one of the leaders of the first expedition that crossed the Blue Mountains, which would open vast grasslands to the squatters. A town on these mountains is still named after him. His sympathies were with the convicts, perhaps because of his father, who was accused of highway robbery and had to accept transportation to Australia to avoid trial and possible conviction. At this time, Wentworth was a strong advocate of more inclusive political institutions, an elected assembly, trial by jury for ex-convicts and their families, and an end to transportation to New South Wales. He started a newspaper, The Australian, which would from then on lead the attack on the existing political institutions. MacArthur didn't like Wentworth, and certainly not what he was asking for. He went through a list of Wentworth's supporters, characterizing them as follows. Sentenced to be hung since he came here. Repeatedly flogged at the cart's tail. A London Jew. Jew publican lately deprived of his license. Auctioneer transported for trading in slaves. Often flogged here. Son of two convicts. A swindler, deeply in debt. An American adventurer. An attorney with a worthless character. A stranger lately failed here in a music shop. Married to the daughter to two convicts. Married to a convict who was formerly a tambourine girl. MacArthur and the squatters' vigorous opposition could not stop the tide in Australia, however. The demand for representative institutions was strong and could not be suppressed. Until 1823, the governor, Sir Ralph Darling, had ruled New South Wales more or less on his own. In that year, his powers were limited by the creation of a council appointed by the British government. Initially, the appointees were from the squatters and non-convict elite, MacArthur among them, but this couldn't last. In 1831, the governor, Richard Burke, bowed to pressure and for the first time allowed ex-convicts to sit on juries. Ex-convicts, and in fact many new free settlers, also wanted transportation of convicts from Britain to stop, because it created competition in the labor market and drove down wages. The squatters liked low wages, but they lost. In 1840, transportation to New South Wales was stopped, and in 1842, a legislative council was created with two-thirds of its members being elected, the rest appointed. Ex-convicts could stand for office and vote if they held enough property, and many did. By the 1850s, Australia had introduced adult white male suffrage. The demands of the citizens, ex-convicts, and their families were now far ahead of what William Wentworth had first imagined. In fact, by this time, he was on the side of conservatives insisting on an unelected legislative council. But, just like MacArthur before, Wentworth would not be able to halt the tide toward more inclusive political institutions. In 1856, the state of Victoria, which had been carved out of New South Wales in 1851, and the state of Tasmania, would become the first places in the world to introduce an effective secret ballot in elections, which stopped vote buying and coercion. Today, we still call the standard method of achieving secrecy in voting in elections the Australian ballot. The initial circumstances in Sydney, New South Wales, were very similar to those in Jamestown, Virginia, 181 years earlier, though the settlers at Jamestown were mostly indentured laborers rather than convicts. In both cases, the initial circumstances did not allow for the creation of extractive colonial institutions. Neither colony had dense populations of indigenous peoples to exploit, ready access to precious metals such as gold or silver, or soil and crops that would make slave plantations economically viable. The slave trade was still vibrant in the 1780s, and New South Wales could have been filled up with slaves had it been profitable. It wasn't. Both the Virginia Company and the soldiers and free settlers who ran New South Wales bowed to the pressures, gradually creating inclusive economic institutions that developed in tandem with inclusive political institutions. This happened with even less of a struggle in New South Wales than it had in Virginia, and subsequent attempts to put this trend into reverse failed. Australia, like the United States, experienced a different path to inclusive institutions than the one taken by England. The same revolutions that shook England during the Civil War and then the Glorious Revolution were not needed in the United States or Australia because of the very different circumstances in which those countries were founded, though this of course does not mean that inclusive institutions were established without any conflict, and in the process, the United States had to throw off British colonialism. In England, there was a long history of absolutist rule that was deeply entrenched and required a revolution to remove it. In the United States and Australia, there was no such thing, though Lord Baltimore in Maryland and John MacArthur in New South Wales might have aspired to such a role, they could not establish a strong enough grip on society for their plans to bear fruit. The inclusive institutions established in the United States and Australia meant that the Industrial Revolution spread quickly to these lands, and they began to get rich. The path these countries took was followed by colonies such as Canada and New Zealand. There were still other paths to inclusive institutions. Large parts of Western Europe took yet a third path to inclusive institutions under the impetus of the French Revolution, which overthrew absolutism in France and then generated a series of interstate conflicts that spread institutional reform across much of Western Europe. The economic consequence of these reforms was the emergence of inclusive economic institutions in most of Western Europe, the Industrial Revolution, and economic growth. Breaking the barriers, the French Revolution. For the three centuries prior to 1789, France was ruled by an absolutist monarchy. French society was divided into three segments, the so-called estates. The aristocrats, the nobility, made up the first estate, the clergy the second estate, and everybody else the third estate. Different estates were subject to different laws, and the first two estates had rights that the rest of the population did not. The nobility and the clergy did not pay taxes, while the citizens had to pay several different taxes, as we would expect from a regime that was largely extractive. In fact, not only was the church exempt from taxes, but it also owned large swaths of land and could impose its own taxes on peasants. The monarch, the nobility, and the clergy enjoyed a luxurious lifestyle, while much of the third estate lived in dire poverty. Different laws not only guaranteed a greatly advantageous economic position to the nobility and the clergy, but it also gave them political power. Life in French cities of the 18th century was harsh and unhealthy. Manufacturing was regulated by powerful guilds, which generated good incomes for their members, but prevented others from entering these occupations or starting new businesses. The so-called Ancien Régime prided itself on its continuity and stability. Entry by entrepreneurs and talented individuals into new occupations would create instability and was not tolerated. If life in the cities was harsh, life in the villages was probably worse. As we have seen, by this time, the most extreme form of serfdom, which tied people to the land and forced them to work for and pay dues to the feudal lords, was long in decline in France. Nevertheless, there were restrictions on mobility and a plethora of feudal dues that the French peasants were required to pay to the monarch, the nobility, and the church. Against this background, the French Revolution was a radical affair. On August 4, 1789, the National Constituent Assembly entirely changed French laws by proposing a new constitution. The first article stated, "The National Assembly hereby completely abolishes the feudal system. It decrees that among the existing rights and dues, both feudal and sensual, all those originating in or representing real or personal serfdom shall be abolished without indemnification. Its ninth article then continued, pecuniary privileges, personal or real, in the payment of taxes are abolished forever. Taxes shall be collected from all the citizens and from all property, in the same manner and in the same form. Plans shall be considered by which the taxes shall be paid proportionally by all, even for the last 6 months of the current year. Thus, in one swoop, the French Revolution abolished the feudal system and all the obligations and dues that it entailed, and it entirely removed the tax exemptions of the nobility and the clergy. But perhaps what was most radical, even unthinkable at the time, was the 11th article, which stated, all citizens without distinction of birth are eligible to any office or dignity, whether ecclesiastical, civil, or military, and no profession shall imply any derogation. So there was now equality before the law for all, not only in daily life and business, but also in politics. The reforms of the revolution continued after August 4th. It subsequently abolished the church's authority to levy special taxes and turned the clergy into employees of the state. Together with the removal of the rigid political and social roles, critical barriers against economic activities were stamped out. The guilds and all occupational restrictions were abolished, creating a more level playing field in the cities. These reforms were a first step toward ending the reign of the absolutist French monarchs. Several decades of instability and war followed the declarations of August 4th. But an irreversible step was taken away from absolutism and extractive institutions and toward inclusive political and economic institutions. These changes would be followed by other reforms in the economy and in politics, ultimately culminating in the Third Republic in 1870. Which would bring to France the type of parliamentary system that the Glorious Revolution put in motion in England. The French Revolution created much violence, suffering, instability, and war. Nevertheless, thanks to it, the French did not get trapped with extractive institutions blocking economic growth and prosperity, as did absolutist regimes of Eastern Europe, such as Austria-Hungary and Russia. How did the absolutist French monarchy come to the brink of the 1789 revolution? After all, we have seen that many absolutist regimes were able to survive for long periods of time, even in the midst of economic stagnation and social upheaval. As with most instances of revolutions and radical changes, it was a confluence of factors that opened the way to the French Revolution. And these were intimately related to the fact that Britain was industrializing rapidly. And of course the path was, as usual, contingent, as many attempts to stabilize the regime by the monarchy failed, and the revolution turned out to be more successful in changing institutions in France and elsewhere in Europe than many could have imagined in 1789. Many laws and privileges in France were remnants of medieval times. They not only favored the first and second estates relative to the majority of the population, but also gave them privileges vis-à-vis the crown. Louis XIV, the Sun King, ruled France for 54 years between 1661 to his death in 1715, though he actually came to the throne in 1643 at the age of 5. He consolidated the power of the monarchy, furthering the process toward greater absolutism that had started centuries earlier. Many monarchs often consulted the so-called Assembly of Notables, consisting of key aristocrats handpicked by the crown. Though largely consultative, the assembly still acted as a mild constraint on the monarch's power. For this reason, Louis XIV ruled without convening the assembly. Under his reign, France achieved some economic growth, for example, via participation in Atlantic and colonial trade. Louis's able minister of finance, Jean-Baptiste Colbert, also oversaw the development of government-sponsored and government-controlled industry, a type of extractive growth. This limited amount of growth benefited almost exclusively the first and second estates. Louis XIV also wanted to rationalize the French tax system. Because the state often had problems financing its frequent wars, its large standing army, and the king's own luxurious retinue, consumption, and palaces. Its inability to tax even the minor nobility put severe limits on its revenues. Though there had been little economic growth by the time Louis XVI came to power in 1774, there had nevertheless been large changes in society. Moreover, the earlier fiscal problems had turned into a fiscal crisis, and the 7 Years' War with the British between 1756 and 1763, in which France lost Canada, had been particularly costly. A number of significant figures attempted to balance the royal budget by restructuring the debt and increasing taxes. Among them were Anne Robert Jacques Turgot, one of the most famous economists of the time, Jacques Necker, who would also play an important role after the Revolution, and Charles Alexandre de Calonne. But none succeeded. Calonne, as part of his strategy, persuaded Louis XVI to summon the Assembly of Notables. The king and his advisers expected the Assembly to endorse his reforms much in the same way as Charles I expected the English Parliament to simply agree to pay for an army to fight the Scottish when he called it in 1640. The Assembly took an unexpected step and decreed that only a representative body, the Estates General, could endorse such reforms. The Estates General was a very different body from the Assembly of Notables. While the latter consisted of the nobility and was largely hand-picked by the crown from among major aristocrats, the former included representatives from all three estates. It had last been convened in 1614. When the Estates General gathered in 1789 in Versailles, it became immediately clear that no agreement could be reached. There were irreconcilable differences, as the Third Estate saw this as its chance to increase its political power and wanted to have more votes in the Estates General, which the nobility and the clergy steadfastly opposed. The meeting ended on May 5, 1789, without any resolution, except the decision to convene a more powerful body, the National Assembly, deepening the political crisis. The Third Estate, particularly the merchants, businessmen, professionals, and artisans, who all had demands for greater power, saw these developments as evidence of their increasing clout. In the National Assembly, they therefore demanded even more say in the proceedings and greater rights in general. Their support in the streets all over the country by citizens emboldened by these developments led to the reconstitution of the Assembly as the National Constituent Assembly on July 9th. Meanwhile, the mood in the country, and especially in Paris, was becoming more radical. In reaction, the conservative circles around Louis XVI persuaded him to sack Necker, the reformist finance minister. This led to further radicalization in the streets. The outcome was the famous storming of the Bastille on July 14, 1789. From this point onward, the revolution started in earnest. Necker was reinstated, and the revolutionary Marquis de Lafayette was put in charge of the National Guard of Paris. Even more remarkable than the storming of the Bastille were the dynamics of the National Constituent Assembly, which on August 4, 1789, with its newfound confidence, passed the new constitution, abolishing feudalism and the special privileges of the First and Second Estates. But this radicalization led to fractionalization within the Assembly, since there were many conflicting views about the shape that society should take. The first step was the formation of local clubs, most notably the radical Jacobin Club, which would later take control of the revolution. At the same time, the nobles were fleeing the country in great numbers, the so-called émigrés. Many were also encouraging the king to break with the Assembly and take action, either by himself or with the help of foreign powers such as Austria, the native country of Queen Marie Antoinette, and where most of the émigrés had fled. As many in the streets started to see an imminent threat against the achievements of the revolution over the past 2 years, radicalization gathered pace. The National Constituent Assembly passed the final version of the Constitution on September 29, 1791, turning France into a constitutional monarchy with equality of rights for all men, no feudal obligations or dues, and an end to all trading restrictions imposed by guilds. France was still a monarchy, but the king now had little role and, in fact, not even his freedom. But the dynamics of the revolution were then irreversibly altered by the war that broke out in 1792 between France and the First Coalition led by Austria. The war increased the resolve and radicalism of the revolutionaries and of the masses, the so-called sans-culottes, which translates as without knee breeches, because they could not afford to wear the style of trousers then fashionable. The outcome of this process was the period known as the Terror.